from the high desert and the great American Southwest. I bid you all good morning, good afternoon, good evening, whatever it may be, in whatever time zone you reside in, every single one of them covered like a blanket by this program, Coast to Coast AM. I'm Art Bell, my honor to be escorting you through the weekend. This is Open Lines. That means exactly what it says, open lines, with the exception of one. One idea struck me big time, so let me get that out of the way right now. I'm going to hold one line open, and I would like to thank, well, who is it? Steve and Mousetrap. What kind of name is that? Steve and Mousetrap. If somebody was really named Mousetrap, shame on their parents. Anyway, thank you both, Steve and Mousetrap. Please open a line tonight for anyone that has made a pact with the devil and find out how that pact is coming out. And also ask how they came to ask for the pact in the first place. And I thought that a Jim Dandy idea. Malachi Martin was on here. Father Malachi Martin, for years, he had suggested that many out there had made pacts with the devil. And indeed, if any of you are willing to talk about the deal you made, how you came to make it, and how it's coming so far, you know, we'd like to know how it's going, then we're going to hold one line open for you. That would be area code 775-727-1222. That normally would be the first time caller line, but in this case, it's only for people who have made a pact with the devil. You've got to imagine those are going to be some interesting stories. All right, with that in mind, a few things before we get started. Number one, I direct your attention to the coasttocoastam.com website. We got a beaut for you here, folks. I mean, we really got a beaut. Dr. Mark Olson of Sonora Sightings writes, I've attached footage, Art, of the triangular UFO that I videotaped while you were on the air, while I was on the air. And you'll hear sound in the background. It was August 8th, 2004. The UFO appeared over Lion's Bald Mountain and flew over my head very slowly, heading south. No sound. It was awesome. No question, it was a triangle. No question, on that very night, synchronistically, I was on the air talking about triangles, black triangles, with callers while ABC was here filming a documentary. Now, this thing is incredible. This looks like what my wife and I saw it at a closer range, but what this man filmed while I was on the air that night is awesomely like what we saw, kind of in miniature to my eyes, but there's no question about it. There's no FAA-type lights. There are three lights. It is a triangle, and you can hear the audio. You're not going to be able to hear it here. Yeah, you can actually hear the guy talking about it. A triangle. Oh, my God, he says, as this thing is zipping along. You can actually see it in movement in the sky. No question about it, a flying triangle, a very clearly defined triangle at the synchronistic moment that I was talking about it on ABC. And by the way, with regard to that ABC special, while you go up to the website and take a look at this incredible video, video is good. You know, it's one of those things you can put your hands on and say, yeah, baby, look at that. That's a real McCoy, and that guy got it on tape. Congratulations to you, my friend. And so if he calls tonight, certainly I'd like to speak with him. Anybody who has a presence of mind to get out a video camera and nail the proof is my kind of guy. All right, so we've got one line reserved away for people who have made pacts with the devil. You know that's going to be interesting. And then we have a number of people that have told me stories ahead of time that I already have waiting to tell them. And then we have all of you. It's going to be an extremely interesting night. Stay right there. I've got a little more before the phones. trust me, that footage up on the website right now is worth watching. I mean, it really is. I would call that prima facie evidence. I mean, good evidence, the kind that people with video cameras can get. Here he was listening to the program we were doing with ABC, and it happened. And speaking of that documentary, as you know, ABC was here for a couple of days. Now, that's probably going to boil down to about 30 seconds of video, but this, I think we've got to give them credit. It's the UFO phenomena. Seeing is believing is what they're titling it. The UFO phenomena, seeing is believing. 2 hours prime time on ABC television, Thursday, February 24th at 8 o'clock. And let's read a little bit of this. February 4th, 2005, almost 50% of Americans, that'd be half of us, according to recent polls, and millions of people elsewhere in the world believe that UFOs are real. For many, it is a deeply held belief. For decades, there have been sightings of UFOs by millions and millions of people. It is a mystery that only science can solve. And yet the phenomena remains largely unexamined. Most of the reporting on the subject by the mainstream media holds those who claim to have seen UFOs up to ridicule. On February 24th, Peter Jennings' reporting, UFOs, Seeing is Believing, takes a fresh look at the UFO phenomena. As a journalist, says Jennings, I began this project with a healthy dose of skepticism and an open mind as possible. After almost 150 interviews with scientists, investigators, and many of those who claim to have witnessed unidentified flying objects, there are important questions that have not been completely answered and a great deal not fully explained. Peter Jennings' reporting UFOs, Seeing is Believing, airs Thursday, February 24th, 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern on ABC. The program will be broadcast in high definition, by the way. So probably I'll have, you know, all of 30 seconds on it or something. But they did record out here for a couple of days. So it's going to be very interesting to see what shows up. They interviewed many, many, many of the very best. And so giving them credit, here is a major U.S. network actually going out there and doing a serious show on UFOs. Mark it down on your calendar, February 24th, 8 o'clock. I don't know the rest of them, Central, Pacific, you know, you add it up for your area, check your guide and all that. The New England Patriots must have seen it, right? Don't have to proclaim greatness. The NFL record book does that for them. The Patriots won their third Super Bowl in 4 years Sunday, 24-21 over the Eagles. And now, indeed, they are challenging history. It was their ninth straight postseason victory, equaling Vince Lombardi's Green Bay Packers. It was Coach Belichick's 10th playoff victory in 11 games. 10th playoff victory in 11 games. One better than the great Lombardi. And it matched Dallas's run of three championships in 4 years in the early 1990s. So, it was good. Gunmen waylaid a minibus Sunday carrying foreign technicians to their jobs at a mobile telephone company in western Baghdad, seizing four Egyptians in the second kidnapping of foreigners in the Iraqi capital within a week. We're going to be talking to somebody in a moment who was kidnapped, as a matter of fact, by Al-Qaeda. Pope John Paul II blessed the faithful from his hospital window Sunday, looking frail, speaking with difficulty, but determined to show he can still lead the Roman Catholic Church. He's hanging in there. Nobody was worried when Paul McCartney stripped off his jacket midway through his halftime performance at the Super Bowl. All was revealed was a long-sleeved shirt, and nothing malfunctioned, and all went well. And the legend that is McCartney did a wonderful halftime performance. Kenny Young is dead, folks. He's going to be very much missed in the UFO community. This is from Whitley Strieber's unknowncountry.com. One of America's most skilled and important UFO investigators, Kenny Young, has died of cancer at just age 38. Kenny has had the disease for some time, but requested that Whitley, who followed his career closely, not disclose his illness publicly, and of course Whitley did not. Kenny was a sober, careful, skeptical UFO researcher, and Whitley believed him to be among the very best of the younger generation whose work is characterized by just the facts approach that doesn't attempt to fit findings to theories, but simply seeks to prove what is real. Goodbye, Kenny. You will be missed. Keeping track of this, the virus, the headline is Cambodia confirms bird flu in poultry near capital, Phnom Penh. Bird flu has been found in chickens near the Cambodian capital, officials said today, raising fears about the spread of the deadly virus in a country that has little to no health system at all. The H5N1 virus strain was detected in dead chickens at a small poultry farm in the province of Candel, just south of Phnom Penh. The agricultural ministry said people are now aware of the virus, and when they suspected a case, they reported it to us. The bird flu has now hit our country again. We must all watch this like a hawk, this bird flu thing. The scientists have been regularly predicting it's going to turn into some sort of pandemic, and like a rumbling from a mountain getting ready to go, the stories just keep coming. And now, here's another one of those "the stories just keep coming" things. The headline is Melting Away, a Slow Motion Catastrophe. A scientist looking southward from the tip of South America over steel-gray waters toward icy Antarctica see only questions on the horizon about the fate of the planet. Now that one mammoth Antarctic ice shelf has collapsed into the ocean, when might another, bigger one crumble and slip into the warming sea in 1,000 years, 100, sooner, never? People don't have the answers to the questions yet, but there is a probability, possibility of a collapse. Scientists had just flown back from the icy continent to this expedition staging point, and they brought with them some potentially very unsettling news. On a 2-month round-trip trek by snow tractor to the South Pole, they pointed their sophisticated radar at the ground, and they found the West Antarctic ice sheet may be much thicker than thought, many hundreds of feet thicker, in fact, in parts. Now, if that's true, and of course if the melting part is true, that means a great deal more water is going to go into those rising ocean levels. And we're hearing very, very disturbing things about the Antarctic right now, and the rate of the melting going on, and the rate of the warming that's going on. It's all very, very worrisome, both at the north and south parts of the world. All right, with that in mind, I do have more, but I'll hold it and kind of sprinkle it as we continue through the program. Let us begin here on the Wild Card Line. You're on the air. Good morning. Hello.
Hello.
Yes, sir.
This is Greg Williams.
Greg, hi. Welcome to the program.
Oh, okay.
Go ahead and begin your story wherever you want to. You were held prisoner by Al-Qaeda, is that right?
Right.
First of all, where did this occur?
In the Philippines.
In the Philippines. Where still a very great deal of Al-Qaeda today, I believe, virtually controls parts of the Philippines. Is that not correct?
Not really. After they got the Burnhams out, they pretty much had killed and captured most of the Abu Sayyaf leaders, all except one who is now hiding out with another group called the MNLF. They're a group that has been, and another Islamic group that's been fighting for land, and the government actually gave them some land in Mindanao. So the remnants of the Abu Sayyaf have been hiding there, and there's been these guys from Indonesia, Islamia, whatever, I can't remember the whole name, but the guys who did the Bali bombing and stuff like that, they've been over there teaching the Abu Sayyaf how to bomb. And they've set off a couple of bombs down there in the southern Philippines, killing people.
Uh-huh. Well, we hear a lot about it. Yeah. Anyway, how did it come that you went to the Philippines anyway, William?
Well, that's really the whole story. It's about sort of really about my spiritual journey through life and how I grew up here in Rockford, Illinois, and ended up doing things I wanted to do, like playing rock and roll and then moving to Florida and becoming a pretty successful businessman. And how in 1993 I had an accident where my back was injured, and things went one downhill from there, and I got abandoned by my wife, and my job squeezed me out, and even my parents up here in Rockford wouldn't take me back because they just simply didn't believe it was that bad. And even I didn't realize at the time I was becoming disabled. So
When it rains, it really pours, doesn't it?
Yeah, I'll tell you. I mean, I was blessed to have, I really had a blessed life, and then all of a sudden it was just turned upside down.
All right, so how do you get from Florida and a disintegrating life to the Philippines?
Well, the only people there for me in Florida was the church, and I was going to church, had some friends there. I went to a singles night, and the pastor was giving a sermon on the missions that the church is involved in, and I do speak some Spanish, and they were, when I expressed some interest, they wanted to send me to Cuba, and I said, no, I worked in Miami too long, I have too many friends down there, I wouldn't betray them, and found out that the Philippines, their second language is English, and I thought, well, this could be a good place to go, and, you know, I just basically made the decision I didn't want to languish on the streets as a homeless person, and, you know, soup lines and things.
Philippines
like that
sounds better than homeless, yes.
At least,
okay.
Yeah, at least I'd be doing something.
So there you are, behalf of the church, on the way to the Philippines.
Yeah.
All right, then what?
Well, when I arrived, there was another twist, because the pastor who I had been in contact with, who was supposed to meet me there in Manila, he had injured himself in a construction accident, and he was not there, so I didn't know what to do.
So you weren't greeted by anybody at the airport?
Oh, no.
Okay.
Actually, I wasn't supposed to be anyway. I was. They gave me the address, and he faxed me a bunch of information about where the Holiday Inn was, and the church he's at is just like a couple blocks away.
So you decided to just walk?
Oh, yeah. I checked into the Holiday Inn, and I walked over there, and he wasn't there. So I had met somebody on the airplane coming down who it was pretty eerie, actually. She was a blind woman, and she had Filipino guys with her, and she was called the Blind Prophet. And she did a Christian crusade every year. And when we were talking, she made a very cryptic comment to me. She said, when I told her I was already, you know, I had a mission that I was going to be going to, and because they invited me to go with them, she said, I look forward to you coming with us.
So you called her?
Yeah. So here I was with nobody, and I called her, and I said, well, I guess I'd like to go with you guys. And what they did is they headed down into the southern Philippines where, unbeknownst to me and most other people, that's where the Abu Sayyaf was active.
Now, I think I'm aware of that. And so how did they get you?
Well, we were getting ready to go to another island, and one morning, and we got separated. The entourage and the Blind Prophet got into two cabs, and then they didn't have enough for us. So we had myself and my companion, my Filipino friend, and just the two of us caught a second cab a few minutes later. This guy was trying to catch up to him, and he took a shortcut through the Cebu Harbor port and went through the area where they had stacks and stacks of these big train car kind of freight things. And he came around the corner, and all of a sudden we're surrounded by about four or five guys with black ski masks and AK-47s.
So, in other words, this taxi driver drove you right into the trap.
Yeah. People always ask me, do you think he did it on purpose? I know he didn't do it on purpose. I know he did it by mistake. He was not working with them because he was killed later on when they took us by speedboat.
So they took not only you two, but the cab driver as well?
Yes. Basically, why they pulled, for some reason, I don't know why, they pulled them out and started beating them. And they pulled me out. They did hit me on the head, knocked me out for a few minutes, and then they put sacks on our heads and led us on to this little speedboat, and we were on that for several hours as they took us to this other island.
And already you're thinking Miami doesn't sound so bad anymore, I'm sure.
Yeah, I was quite confused. I just kept thinking, what would they want with me? I'm a homeless person with no money, no future, no nothing.
But they didn't know that, did they?
Oh, no, they knew about the crusade.
All right, hold it right there.
Sure.
We'll be right back. We're at the bottom of the hour. It gets worse from here.
You get a shiver in the dark. It's raining in the park. But meantime, sound of the river, you're stopping your whole everything. A band is blowing Dixie, double fall time. You feel alright when you hear the music ring. Well, now you step inside, but you don't see too many faces. Coming in out of the rain and hear the jazz go down. Competition in other places.
With Art Bell, call the Wildcard line at area code 775-727-1295. The first time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll free at 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call Art at 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art Bell by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5, and dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
It is, and we're talking with Greg Williams, who was a prisoner of Al-Qaeda for quite a while. Tortured, beheadings went on. You'll hear all about it, the rest of his story. And what a story it's got to be. I mean, you're a homeless guy. You barely make it to the Philippines. You end up going with somebody you probably shouldn't have into a cab where you no doubt shouldn't have been. And guys grab you and throw sacks over your head. And I guess that's how it began. By the way, we have a customer standing by on our Let's Make a Deal line. But right now, back to Greg. Greg, so you're a prisoner of Al-Qaeda. You didn't really know they were Al-Qaeda. You didn't know who they were. All you had was bag on your head, and they took you on some journey?
Yeah. All I knew about the Philippines was about Marcos and the communist guerrillas, so I assumed these were either just bandits or communist guerrillas. They took us several hours over the oceans between the islands.
Oh.
Took us to the island of Isilan, which is one of the islands, home islands of the Abu Sayyaf.
But I'm sure you didn't know that at the time, what it was, that is to say.
Yeah, I had no idea.
You get there, and then what?
Well, we went on about an hour or two trip up the mountains, and then they split us up. I never saw the cab driver, my friend, his name was Remy. Never saw them during the first 11 or 12 days that I was there.
How long were you there altogether?
13 days. That's the name of my book. It's called.
You're writing a book about this called 13 Days.
Well, it's already been published. It's been out for about a year.
Okay.
And it's called 13 Days of Terror. And I tell people not to be fooled by the title, because it really is I wrote the book to be an inspirational book about how you can rise from the ashes, so to speak, which I did.
Or at one point, it's seemingly ashes to ashes. I don't know. From Miami and a wrecked life to an island with a bag over your head. Anyway, what happened during those 13 days?
Well, in the beginning, they hung me up with my arms behind me, and hung me up from a palm tree facing down. And they did things like poke me and stick knives in my face and give me rice with ants in it. And of course, I was sunburned, and the mosquitoes were bad. It was.
Did they ever tell you what they wanted?
Well, that's what was strange. The first couple of days, they didn't say anything to me. That's not true. They were actually, what they did, and they had said this a couple times during the trip up the mountain, they kept saying, "You're a missionary." You know, they kept saying, "You're a missionary." And then when I said, "No, I'm not a missionary," they would just laugh at me.
Uh-huh.
Because they were, obviously they thought I was a missionary, and obviously they thought I was part of an important organization.
And that had money.
Exactly.
Uh-huh.
Exactly. And it wasn't until they got the interpreter involved, I think it was about the third day or so, that he translated. He spoke pretty good English, and that was when I found out more about what they intended to do and what they wanted.
And what did they intend to do, and what did they want?
Well, they wanted money. They wanted me to tell them where they could contact the company that would give money for me.
Yeah.
And I was still, even during these interrogations, were getting a little bit more heated and that kind of thing. I remember there was a telling moment when during they were still saying, "You are a missionary. We know you're a missionary." And I finally realized, it hit me like an anvil over the head. I'd better shut up. I better quit saying I'm non-missionary, because these guys, from what I had seen, if I wasn't useful to them in some way, they'd just probably just kill me. And that's when I started playing a little more coy with them and stopped saying that I was not a missionary. But it got worse. They did take me down, and they shackled me by chain in this little hut. And at least in the hut, I had some shade.
Yes.
And I did strange little things like playing marbles with seeds in little holes. And one of the highlights was when I was feeling quite in despair, I had this little mole, this little black mole. You know, they have the big, long snout. He used to visit once in a while and eat some of my scraps, like any rice that I had on the ground. And one day, during the afternoon, he came to visit me. And he didn't even look for food. I was lying down, and he curled up in the back of my knee and went to sleep.
Hmm.
And it was like the hand of God touched me and said, I'm still here.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, you were tortured during that time?
Yeah.
What way?
Well, after a few days, they got really frustrated with me, and they took me to a cave. It was an old Japanese fortification in a cave. And one of their chief torturers, his name was Abu Sabaya. In fact, he was the same guy who was in charge of the Burnhams when they kidnapped the Burnhams. Fortunately, he's now dead. He began beating me. Then he began stabbing my fingers with big livestock needle. He crushed one of my fingers with a rifle butt. And then he started taking needles and sticking them into my fingers and, like digging around with them. But he did something that I found out later was their trademark. He would take his hunting knife and jab it underneath my fingernails and then take pliers and start pulling my fingernails up very slowly.
Oh, my God.
Very, very painful, but it's their trademark torture. Now, since
you were being tortured, I mean, there's usually a reason for torture. Was it just for fun, or were they trying to get information, specific information about who to get the money from?
Both. These people were just vicious animals. While I was there, I witnessed them beheading a farmer. I witnessed them raping some girls who were no more than 13. They were doing drugs. They were drinking. And everything they were saying about their grand Islamic plans just didn't make sense, because these people...
They weren't acting very Islamic if they were raping and...
Exactly. They certainly weren't godly people. And but during the height of that, when they were pulling my fingernails out, I had an out-of-body experience. I thought I was dying. And the Lord just lifted me up, and I was in a very... I was looking down on myself. That's why I thought I was dying, and it was just very tranquil. I felt very safe and secure. And it really changed me spiritually. And after that point, I never again had any fear.
They beheaded your friend?
Yeah, well, after that, when they couldn't get anything out of me then they brought my friend up, who I hadn't seen in 11 days. And they brought him in front of me and just immediately lopped his head off right in front of me. And, you know, obviously it did have an effect on me. It scared the crap out of me. And
I'm sure they chopped his head off?
Yeah. Well, in the book, I made it sound like it was a clean, swift chop and his head went rolling.
And it wasn't?
Unfortunately, people in Iraq will tell you, unfortunately, that's not what happens when they behead people. It's quite a gruesome sawing and chipping, and it's just really gross. It's not a quick chop, let's put it that way.
Oh my God. So after all of this, by then I'm sure you think you're just dead. And
I knew it. And even though I bought a couple of days just by throwing out a name of a place I had heard, they did come back and they told me that, quote unquote, your head, tomorrow your head goes to Cebu as a warning to the whites. Basically meaning the Christian whites that were in the Philippines.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very much afraid of that group. And I knew, you know, I was in great despair that night and crying and trying to, you know, imagine myself and my children and my family not even knowing what happened to me. You know, it was quite a terrible moment for me. But I made peace with the Lord.
All right, we don't have a lot of time, and your escape was made by befriending, I guess, you said that some of the guards were high as a kite or passed out sort of on something or another, and you started talking to the translator?
Yeah, they were partying as usual, and they were bringing girls into the tunnel, and they passed out, and the translator didn't drink. And so I knew he was a little different, but anyway, we had a really good conversation the first civilized conversation I'd had since I've been there, and we talked a lot about our children and our families.
Yeah, it's the night of your execution, night before your execution.
Exactly. No, this was like...
Well, you said they had said they were going to take your head the next day.
Yeah, but what happened, this conversation I had with the translator actually happened a couple days before that. And what I didn't know is during that conversation, we were challenging each other about our religious beliefs, somehow his mind changed. And so it was after that they brought Remy to me and chopped his head off, and I was in great despair. Of course, I had no idea this guy was going to come back. But for some reason, during our conversation, it touched him. And he came back, and I'd just gone to sleep. Must have been like 4 or 5 in the morning, and he came back, and the guard was passed out, got the keys, unlocked us. And he had grown up as a child in those caves. He knew there was a back entrance out of there, a small little air shaft that someone thin could squeeze through. And
by then you were thin.
Yes, I was. I had lost quite a bit of weight, and this guy was thin anyway, but nobody saw him come in, and we were able to go out through this area. He brought a little pocket knife with him and cut away the vegetation that had been over this air shaft for 50-some years. And I followed him very weakly and stumbling down the mountainside to his little house and his family. And he had one of his daughters happened to be going to another island on a fishing boat, and his plan was to, you know, get me out of there.
And he did.
Yeah.
Well, that's some story. Greg, do you think that, do you think the West, and I use that as an all-inclusive phrase, you know, the West is going to be at war with Islam. Is that where this is eventually going? Is it inevitable? Is even
no,
a better question.
I don't think it is. I think there's a lot of extremists out there who are blaming the religion. And one of the great things about my book is it really, I hope it clarifies, and I know a lot of people have said it has, that even though this guy was a Muslim, he felt a kinship with me because I was a man of faith also, even though I was a Christian. And it really showed me, really opened my eyes, that there's still so many good people, much more than the bad people, and that what's happened is this small percentage of 4 or 5% of the Muslims have tried to hijack their religion. And there are other Muslims, like this guy who saved me, who are going to start cleaning up their own backyard.
I wonder how he made out.
Well, I know that he moved away.
I'm sure he did, yes.
And I know through his daughter, who cared for me after I left the island, that he actually asked for a Bible. So the big thing I learned was when I was leaving, and I turned to him and I said, you know, why? How could you risk your life and your family? Because I knew these guys would kill him and his family. And I said, how could you risk your life for me? And he said, because I believe we're brothers under the same God.
All right. Well, listen, Greg, I've got to go, but thank you very, very, very much for the story. I hope your book does well. Can you imagine the terror of that? Being chained and watching your friend's head lopped off and getting that close yourself? That's what he went through. That's quite a story. I mean, homeless in Miami and then damn near headless in the Philippines. East of the Rockies, you're on the air. Hello. Hi there.
You doing, Art?
I'm doing okay. This is Kate, right?
Yes.
Excellent, Kate. What can you tell us?
Well, I'm listening to you from KNZR, Bakersfield, California.
Ah, yes. And
I worked in Michelson Lab on China Lake Naval Base in the late 70s.
Oh.
And with what everybody's talking about, the stem cell research and the geneticists dying and the microbiologists, I knew one of these days I would be telling this story, and I feel it is necessary to do so right now.
Well, it's true. I mean, I've had I don't know how many stories about dead microbiologists. Now, maybe somehow the media just decided to start focusing on dead microbiologists, but it seems like there have been so many stories, Kate, that there's something to it, or am I wrong?
No, you're definitely correct. Definitely. And it's none too soon coming. It should have been out a long time ago, but you know how the government is. They don't want to talk about anything, but, you know, we're going to find out. You know, there are those of us who look into these things, and we're very determined and tenacious people.
Yes,
and,
well, you sound like it.
You betcha, honey. I definitely am.
you worked at China Lake.
Yes, I did, sir, in the late 70s after I graduated from high school.
Doing what?
I was working on the cruise missile project.
Oh.
I was a systems analyst and, you know, basically just analyzing all of the information for the missile. And they had Tomahawk and Sidewinder out there also.
Uh-huh.
And the almost 2 years that I was working on the project, 3 days after starting at the lab, I met a gentleman who had an office down the way from mine, and I walked around in the first 3 days and said hello to everybody and introduced myself. And this gentleman was coming out of his office, and I knew by the nameplate that his name was Roger. So I yelled down and I said, Roger, how are you? Good morning. And he didn't stop. And I thought, okay, maybe he didn't hear me. You know, maybe he has a hearing disability or something. So I kind of hurried behind him and tapped him on the shoulder, and I said, Roger, how are you doing today? My name is Kate. I just started. I just wanted to, you know, introduce myself. And he turned and looked at me, and you could see in his face, his name was not Roger, to start off the story there. So over the next few months, I made friends with Roger. He, in the course of speaking with him on our lunch hours, he, from what I gathered, he was at Roswell, so he said. He was 17, so that alerted me to the fact that he was born in 1930.
So this must have been a fairly older fella.
Yeah, yeah. So in 77, I'm not, you know, let me see, 77, and he was born in 30. Well, you guys can do the math. I won't hold you up.
That's fine.
So anyway, during the course of the time that I was there, I only saw him maybe a dozen times. And what bothered me was the fact that he seemed like a very nice fellow, but there was something within his very being that he was fearful of. He did not want to speak of what he was doing. I asked him, well, you know, what do you do here? And he said, oh, I, you know, do this and that. But it wasn't happiness that he, you know, liked his job. He was very just fearful. You could tell that there was something going on that he didn't want to be a part of.
Did you find out what that was?
Well, when I asked him, I kind of trapped him when I asked him what he was doing. And he kind of hemmed and hawed about it. And then when I asked him again, he came out, I'm a geneticist. And then he stopped really short and said, I shouldn't have said that. And I said, so you're in the medical field? And he said, I'm a geneticist. Mm-hmm. I said, what is a geneticist doing on a naval base? And he just looked at me and gave me a look like, don't ask. Do not say another word. And
no.
I said, okay, I'm not going to say another word.
Right.
So I didn't see him every day. There were weeks that would go by that I didn't see him. But one day he came out. I was sitting under the tree out in front having my lunch, and he came out and sat down, and I said, my God, where have you been? I haven't seen you in ages. Are you okay? He had this look of just mortal fear on his face, and he said, you have been seen talking with me. Watch your back. Just
Great.
Be careful.
Great.
And me, you know, I've been into UFOs and all sorts of things my entire life, and of course, with the cruise missile, Tomahawk, and Sidewinder out there, the sightings were incredible. And there are so many stories to that, but I won't bore you to tears with those tonight. But
no, stay with Roger.
You,
I mean, is there more? Do you know what Roger was doing? Did you figure out what Roger was doing?
I didn't know what Roger was doing, but he told me what he gave me an idea of what he was doing at Roswell. He said he was 17 years old. He had enlisted early. Back then, they didn't need the required documentation that they do now, so if you were 14 or 15, you could enlist, and they wouldn't ask any questions. And he told me that he was doing guard duty on something that happened in Roswell, and he looked at me like, you don't need to know.
All right, Kate, hold tight, and we'll finish this up after the break. From the high desert in the nighttime, this is Coast to Coast AM. Weekend version. I'm Art Bell. Keep it where you've got it.